Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States v. Key. Counsel for the defense. And just to confirm the time, are you reserving 8 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge Affleck, fellow judges, may it please the Court. I am Captain Griffin Dunham, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, representing the appellant in this case, and the first class Carl Key. The reason that this court ordered the debate hearing was lost on the military judge that presided over it. She focused the proceeding on the timing of the receipt of a paid informant's receipt of those payments, and not on whether or not the author of those incentive payments was ever discussed with trial defense counsel at the pretrial interview. By not focusing on whether or not those payments were offered to the informant, has now come to prejudice the appellant at the debate hearing where the military judge refused to allow the appellant's trial defense counsel to testify on the issue. Now, whether or not the informant actually was offered these payments is particularly relevant because that opened up an avenue of a potential defense that the defense would have explored at the trial level had there been a relevant information at that critical stage. However, based upon the pretrial interview conducted by the trial defense counsel, it was not disclosed to the defense, and accordingly, they may have had an opportunity to try to impeach that witness and indicate that there could be a potential bias, a motivation to lie, etc.
You've got a substantial problem here, and that is the trial was in October 01. The only payment was made long after the trial. How could her testimony have been affected by a payment she had no knowledge of that wasn't offered or paid until well after the trial?
Your Honor, the moment that she was offered payment for her testimony, or at least her participation in the OSI investigation, that became relevant because as soon as that occurs, that necessarily is going to take her out of the realm of objectivity and instead have this looming over her.
Didn't defense counsel know or should have known that incentive payments like this were authorized and part of OSI procedure?
Potentially not, Your Honor. That is some sort of information that's closely held by OSI.
Well, no, I'm not talking with regard to this particular person. I'm talking with regard to regulations that are public knowledge. Isn't it averred that this kind of payment is authorized in OSI regs?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, did trial defense counsel explore that? She says that nobody asked her.
Yes, Your Honor. Trial defense counsel did explore that. In his affidavit that he submitted in preparation for this proceeding right now and also for the debate hearing, after the debate hearing, he indicated that because he talked to the prosecutor tipped him off that there were payments potentially made or the possibility was out there that she was getting paid, he was keenly aware of that fact and was sensitive to it during the interview. So in his affidavit, he, quote, thoroughly discussed the conversation with her and asked her the questions that would have elicited an affirmative response as to whether or not she was actually offered some type of incentive payment.
Well, is it your position she lied to him?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me ask you a question about this affidavit of Major Martin's. It was not considered, Major Martin was not allowed to testify at the debate hearing, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And this affidavit was also not offered at the debate hearing, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So how is it that either we or the lower court have any jurisdiction to look at this affidavit when it's not part of the debate hearing and it's not part of the record?
In the interest of justice, this court can look at it to determine whether or not the military judge did err. So the purpose of the affidavit, at least its submission before the Air Force Court and this court, is simply to show that the military judge made a mistake at the debate hearing. And it would have been nice to have had that testimony in transcript format. There is an authorized format to be able to submit it to this court, and that's what the defense did.
Well, the lower court's decision turns in part on its analysis of Major Martin's affidavit, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And my question is, how is it that the lower court was able to look at that affidavit?
Because the lower court was able to look at it because when the petition, the brief was submitted to it, that was an additional document that was attached to the brief.
Was it part of the record?
No, Your Honor. It was never part of the record.
Okay.
Counsel, aside from the issue of jurisdiction here, is the issue here, underlying issue, whether the military judge erred in his determination at the subsequent hearing?
Yes, yes.
Okay. If that affidavit or the material in it was not part of the defense counsel's proffer, how can the judge be faulted for his determination when that information was not presented as part of a proffer from the defense as to what they hope to do with the defense counsel's testimony?
The military judge had enough, based upon the debate defense counsel's proffer, in order to determine that Major Martin's testimony would be relevant and should have been admitted. There were additional facts that were included in the affidavit. However, the trial defense counsel, the defense position is the trial defense counsel should not have to be aware of every single fact that would have been testified to, rather put the military judge on sufficient notice in order for the military judge to either voir dire the witness or to conclude that the testimony was admissible and relevant. The Air Force Court, sorry, Your Honor, I see here.
No, go, keep going.
So the Air Force Court did determine that it was relevant testimony, determined that it should have been admitted. However, mooted the first issue in a third level and instead just focused on the new trial aspect of it. However, in the opinion, they did assert that the information that the informant did not give to Major Martin was indeed relevant, and that he did exercise due diligence in trying to come up with that information prior to MQ.
Did they hold it was error to exclude it?
They mooted that issue, and as the second issue was whether or not there was a new trial, the Air Force Court seemed to attempt to moot that. The first issue, whether or not the military judge erred by going ahead and accepting Major Martin's affidavit and then just incorporating that into the judge's findings. However, our position is that even if they incorporate those findings, albeit some of them may have been favorable to the appellant, still it wasn't sufficient enough because the military judge's findings were necessarily flawed.
What standard do we review the CCA's determination of this?
Well, they did not come to any conclusions.
No. They considered it, which is what you want, and then they determined that it did not tip the scales in favor of a new trial. Now, what standards should we apply to the CCA's determination of that?
On the issue of whether or not a new trial should be granted, a de novo review, and then on the facts, a clearly erroneous standard of review as determined by the military judge at the debate hearing.
Okay, so with regard to that, it's clearly erroneous.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So it's the sequence of events that, as a result of this court's decision, further proceedings are offered. At those further proceedings, the defense doesn't make a proffer of what the trial defense counsel would say, and then the defense nonetheless has an opportunity to request a new trial based upon information that was not presented at the debate hearing. Is that the defense position?
No, Your Honor. The defense position is that the defense counsel's proffer at the debate hearing did intelligently inform the military judge as to everything that Major Martin would testify to. I shouldn't say everything, but substantively it was substantial enough that the military judge should have admitted the evidence.
So we can disregard the affidavit at this point?
The proffer does go to show that the military judge erred at that level, and then the additional affidavit provided by Major Martin just demonstrates that the military judge did err. It sort of bolsters that contention that the defense now asserts. And the defense position is that this court can consider that affidavit in determining whether or not a new trial should be granted.
Wouldn't we be considering that affidavit even assuming we can consider the affidavit, isn't the question not whether we decide that he gets a new trial, but whether he is entitled to a full and complete debate hearing where the testimony of this major can be considered?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact,
and that's a different issue than whether he gets a new trial.
Absolutely. From an Article 73 standpoint, we can certainly address the new trial aspect, but at this proceeding, since the military judge erred and didn't allow the information in at the debate hearing, then a form of relief could be a new debate hearing to make sure Major Martin's testimony was included and that the military judge can come to findings of fact based upon that evidence. And really, Major Martin's testimony was the purpose for the debate hearing to be ordered in the first place. And he was going to do a few things. One, he was going to determine, actually, he was going to testify to the informant being incredible, despite the military judge determining that the informant was credible. So that would have affected the findings of fact made by the military judge. And in addition, Major Martin would say that at the trial level, the informant deliberately withheld that information and that she's lying at the Dubay hearing.
Well, taking into account Judge Stuckey's point with respect to her, how important is it whether she was credible about these payments when the payment, if any, came long after the trial, the lower court talked about the other facts that were in the record that would make basically her credibility unimportant. That this was a urinalysis test, that there was other evidence that showed that she was guilty of, that the appellant was guilty of the offense charged. Why is it that your client would be any better off if there was a new debate hearing in light of those additional facts in the record?
From an Air Force Corps standpoint, when they looked at the other evidence that was introduced at the trial, they determined that on the issue of whether or not there was a significant amount of evidence on the record about his consciousness of guilt, they were willing to say that the debate proceedings were not going to affect that. So on the day that he actually provided a urine sample, there were other individuals that testified at trial saying that he was asking questions such as, I'm on medication, do I have to take this test, which showed consciousness of guilt. And the defense doesn't want to get into that area. However, she also testified that 4 weeks prior to the urinalysis, that he was in possession, basically, of 9 ecstasy pills and that those were being offered to her. That's where her credibility is important in this case.
But we have a urinalysis that showed that the individual had tested positive for the metabolite in the urine.
Yes, Your Honor, but if the defense were able to impeach that witness's credibility by showing that she had a financial motive to lie, and she later talks about her kid being the most important thing in her life, if the defense could have changed their strategy and focused on her motivations to lie, now, sure, the conscience of guilt would have come out through other witnesses, but her testimony about what happened 4 weeks prior would have been greatly discounted because now all of a sudden she's not testifying because indeed he had possessed 9 ecstasy pills, but she's testifying so that after the trial she can get paid more money to support her child. So the defense would have been able to impeach her, and that would have reduced her credibility on the issue of opportunity and access to ecstasy for which the possession was admitted at trial. At the Dubay hearing, the defense was able to call the government witnesses, the witnesses that testified for the government at trial, but then when it came time for them to call their own witness, the witness that really had been really paid for by the other witnesses, the military judge stepped in and said, I've heard enough, it's not relevant.
What specifically is in the defense proffer at the trial, not including the affidavit?
The defense proffer at trial is
that would have made it an error for the judge, or that made it an error for the judge to deny the calling of the defense counsel. What specifically did the defense counsel at the Dubay hearing proffer about the testimony that the judge was about to receive?
Yes, Your Honor, on page 65 and 66 of the Dubay hearing, the counsel makes a proffer that, one, if Major Martin were to testify, he would testify that the informant deliberately withheld information from him, and also that the Major Martin would testify about information he received from the informant regarding the issue of money or incentive payments.
Well, it's a little fuzzier than that, isn't it? He's going to testify that he was sure he asked her thoroughly about the issue. He's not going to testify that she lied. He can't know that. He's not going to testify that she gave answer X in response to question Y, because that's not what he's saying. He's saying, I'm sure because I remember that I explored the issue thoroughly. That's a little different, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
It's not nearly as dispositive, is it?
Your Honor, it is dispositive, but I agree that it's certainly fuzzy. The appellant agrees that it's fuzzy. And it's fuzzy because...
But it's fuzzily dispositive.
Yes, Your Honor. It is because although you can't recite the exact facts and the exact words that he used, for example, he couldn't say that he actually used the word offer, his experience as a defense counsel with this case. He remembers thoroughly discussing the issue so that if she were offered incentive payments, that would have come out during that interview. So although it is fuzzy about the exact facts, it is dispositive because he is certain that that would have been elicited from the informant during the pretrial interview. The law does support appellant's position of this on two levels. One is that the defense has to have an opportunity to impeach witnesses, and secondly, that the defense has to have an opportunity to further assert the defense. The Supreme Court has acted on both levels. One, the case of Banks, and prosecutors during a sentencing phase relied upon the status of an individual, actually relied upon the testimony of an individual who happened to have been an informant, but never disclosed this information to the defense. The defense found out after the trial, and that would have been particularly helpful because that could have been used to impeach that witness because they had some sort of motivation to lie. They were getting something out of the deal testifying against the appellant, and therefore that could have significantly augmented the witness's case.
How do you address the judge's finding that in any event, the informant did not know or expect that she would receive any type of payment for her testimony? In paragraph 3,
Yes, Your Honor. And
this is the issue. They may have offered it, but I said, no, I refuse to take it.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is actually in contradiction with page 28.
So is it your position that's a clearly erroneous finding?
It is a clearly erroneous finding because she did know about the incentive payments, and in fact the government concedes that she had knowledge of incentive payments on page 6.
But that's not what the judge is finding. The judge is finding that even if she knew that, and assuming she knew that, if she had taken them off the table by saying, I don't want them. And so in her mind, according to the judge, it didn't matter whether there was a notional concept of incentive payments because it was not applicable to her. That's what I'm asking you to address.
Yes, Your Honor. The genuine nature of that comment made pre-trial should have been able to have been attacked because, as it turns out, she indeed did accept money for her involvement with LSI. So considering that people can change their minds, if you want to call it that, or that people may not be completely forthright in their answers, the member should have been allowed to determine whether or not she was going to accept those in the future, because it was her unilateral decision as to whether or not she was going to accept those payments, in her mind at least.
If the judge's finding is correct, how is that helpful? How is that the dramatic impeachment evidence that you are presenting at trial?
If the military judge's finding is correct that the informant did not know about incentive payments?
No, that she knew about them and said, I don't want them.
It's helpful because then it allows the members to assess her credibility on that particular aspect of her intent, of her motivations, of her position. It just needs to be explored. And in the affidavit that Major Martin provided, he indicates that if he were to have had that information, he would have done a number of things differently during the course of his trial. So that's how it would have been helpful. By just getting it out there, the defense now all of a sudden has a different strategy, a different set of tactics at its disposal. In addition to...
Counsel, let's go back to 65 and 66. I'm trying to find on those pages where the defense counsel at the debate hearing is making his proffer, where he's proffering information that's going to contradict what the witness, confidential informant, had said. What I see in here is the defense counsel telling the military judge what questions the defense counsel would like to ask. Where is the defense counsel saying, and here's what my witness is going to say, and that's why you should admit it?
On page 66, trial defense counsel informs the military judge this is the area that he wants to explore. And now a reasonable inference from that is these are the questions that I'm going to ask of Major Martin. I'm going to explore the issue as to whether or not she deliberately withheld information from Major Martin at the pretrial stage.
That may be enough to show an error by the judge. may or may not. Let's assume that is. How is that enough to show prejudice if the judge hasn't been told what it is? And we're looking at the record here, and we can't tell from the record what it was that the individual was going to say, except by looking at the affidavit that was submitted afterwards. If we're looking solely at the record, where is the judge being told this is what the witness is going to say, and that's why it has to come in?
On page 65 and 66, as you pointed out,
or anywhere else in the record of the Dubay hearing, where is the judge being told, I want to call the trial defense counsel because this is what the trial defense counsel is going to say, and this is how it impeaches what the confidential informant had testified? I think that's the logic of what's going on here.
Yes, Your Honor. And there are no magic words that the defense counsel used at the Dubay hearing to tell the military judge exactly what was going to be said. However, they did confirm necessarily to put the judge on notice as to what the basic gist of what the trial defense counsel's testimony would be, and that really was captured in the second paragraph, first full paragraph of page 66, where the defense counsel states that the only confidential informant used in the case is willfully choosing to withhold information that, if known, would have been cross-examined on and brought out.
I think the exact quote is, I want to explore if the sole government witness is willfully disclosing. That is, trial defense counsel is not even asserting there that the Dubay defense counsel is not even asserting that he's got information to demonstrate that it's a lie. He wants to explore this on the stand now. And even if we assume that the judge should have exercised some latitude in letting it in, I'm trying to figure out where the prejudice is, when the judge hasn't been told specifically what that witness was going to say.
Yes, Your Honor. If this court takes the entire contents of the proffer and then is able to look at page 67, it's clear from the record that there is a matter that's open as to whether or not the informant was getting paid. And the defense counsel tries to use a quotation throughout those 3 to 4 pages of argument or at least discussion about whether or not the informant was paid. Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You can answer this question, and if you want to take some more time, you can take it out of your 8 minutes, or you can address the rest of your argument during your rebuttal time.
Yes, if I may just say...
But please finish your answer to the question.
If you take the entire contents of what the colloquy was back and forth during those 4 pages, it's clear that they really want to get to the issue as to whether or not the issue of whether the informant was paid as part of the investigation into M&Q, that calling Major Martin to testify would not only explore it, but would also answer that question. So there is a reasonable inference to draw the military judge would have known that the purpose of calling Major Martin was to contradict what the informant testified to.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Judge Efron, Honorable Members of the Court, please the Court. My name is Captain Jefferson E. McBride, and together with Colonel Jared L. Bruce, we represent the United States government in this matter. The military judge did not abuse her discretion in refusing to hear what amounts to extraneous, unhelpful, or unclear, at the very least, information from appellant's former trial defense counsel, Captain Martin. The military judge did not need this particular information for either a determination of credibility or due diligence in regards to the overall issue regarding the debate, which is the petition for new trial. Now, bottom line is that the issue for the petition for new trial was thoroughly vetted out. It was fleshed out for the Air Force Court and subsequently for this court to determine the narrow issue that this court suggested needed to be fleshed out. Now, really, the bottom line also is that this particular information could be used really in two ways. One is whether it was impeachment information, in which case the judge could allow it, or maybe as to go into the issue of due diligence. Because at the debate, obviously, we needed to establish through the fact-finding process steps of Langley's credibility in regards to the incentive slash reimbursement payments. He then also further vet out whether or not they, this type of evidence was discoverable, whether they exercised due diligence, and whether it would change the outcome of the court in the end. So, really, though, what you have here is an inadequate proffer by the defense counsel to the military judge suggesting that the information is relevant, but really not asserting why it is, in fact, relevant. So, where the defense counsel says, I want to bring up this particular person explore whether or not she said she received incentive payments or talked about incentive payments, really was a non-issue because she said at the debate hearing that she didn't say that she received incentive payments. So really, what is it that from the proffer that Captain Martin was going to add or impeach? It's really unclear. And in light of the standard here, which is an abuse of discretion, it's not clearly, it's not arbitrary, it's not clearly erroneous in the capacity of what I have is a proffer, an inadequate proffer, and in this court said in Dimbirio that the defense has the duty to establish a foundation in proffering evidence when trying to establish whether or not a piece of information is impeachment or how it's relevant, whether it's logically or legally relevant.
The standard for relevance under military rule of evidence is 401. Under 401 is so low, I'm having difficulty figuring out why the judge just didn't let the defense counsel testify in the situation when it seemed apparent from the little proffer that was given that the defense counsel was going to say something about what the confidential informant had said in their previous discussions, and then it could all be evaluated. It wouldn't have been an issue on appeal. There are some arguments on prejudice here as to the adequacy of proffer, but I'm having difficulty figuring out why the judge wasn't interested in hearing this testimony.
Well, I think the and I'll address harm later as you question the appellant's counsel on. But I think what's pretty clear here is based on the fact that the military judge did a sort of a 403 balancing, if you will. I mean, it was just it's confusing, that kind of thing.
Were there members at this debate hearing?
No.
So here it is, the case is set back to say, develop the facts. And the judge is now engaging in 403 balancing rather than developing the facts. This is a bit mystifying.
Well, I understood, Your Honor, but I think what the military judge was trying to get to ultimately was to show, look, what I have all the relevant information necessary to put on the record for this court to examine the issue of a new trial regarding Sergeant Langley. And whether it's that it's confusing or whether it's cumulative kind of information that she felt at the time, I think that that's actually what she was focusing on. More than the logical relevance of 401, she was focusing on the legal relevance of 403, which I think regardless of members, I think military judge has to take into account. Is this the kind of information that is legally relevant for purposes of the narrow issue proposed by?
Wouldn't have been more appropriate for the judge to listen to that information and then describe it in her findings and conclusions as to its pertinence to the facts that this court asked to be resolved?
Well, I think if we were looking at what is it that a perfect debate hearing would show, perhaps we'd like to see this, perhaps the court would like to see that. But I don't necessarily think that military judge had a duty to flesh out the issue herself based on the proffer. She hears the proffer, and in her mind, feels that this just isn't relevant, whether it's logically or legally relevant. And I don't know without more that she has an obligation under the law to then further flesh out the defense counsel's argument to establish whether or not it's really being offered for impeachment or it's being offered for something else to expand the record. Because from the proffer alone, it doesn't look like that he's offering this piece of information to expand the record and further delineate what hasn't already been established. So I think in that regard, she's probably thinking more along the lines, this is just going to be confusing or probably more cumulative than anything else. And so I think that was the basis of her ruling. We would like to have seen it. That would have been great, but I don't necessarily think that while she had a duty to expand the record based on the proffer.
Wasn't she balancing the quote, whether this was relevant against the issues that calling a prior defense counsel to testify brings into play? I mean, isn't that what she said at page 68? And what does that mean as you understand it? Because I don't understand what it means.
I think that she was just generally trying to balance all the issues, and I think generally in a court martial or any type of hearing, having a prior defense counsel testify can be a little kind of shocking at first blush. And so I think her initial reaction was, wow, I wasn't expecting for this person to testify, whether they just didn't put these witnesses down or whatever. But then I think that just is a thought process she went through. I'm not sure that really had any impact. I think that was more extraneous language was dispositive of why she ruled the way she did.
Counsel, I thought that the question that was sent back to the Dubé was to determine whether or not a new trial would be appropriate. And part of that inquiry is to determine whether or not the evidence would not have been discovered with the exercise of due diligence. Who else but the defense counsel would be able to testify as to due diligence?
Well, I think that information was established by the lack of information by the investigators, but more so with Sergeant Langley's testimony, because I think she was clear about what people were asking me about monies.
Well, that's Langley's perspective. What we're asking here is whether or not the defense exercised due diligence in exploring this issue. And obviously you have Langley's side of the story, but you don't have the side of the story from the defense.
Well, I guess we don't have a fact-finding in regards to due diligence or just a complimentary conclusions of law by another judge saying, I think due diligence was established. But I think there was enough information based on her subsequent decision that this wasn't relevant, that she was probably considering that was established based on Sergeant Langley's testimony, that the questions of monies was brought up by defense counsel, but that she was withholding the information because she didn't deem it relevant. And how else was the defense counsel supposed to flesh out the issue, or that certainly, as the Air Force Court, I think, pointed out, suggested that was a due diligence necessary based on the analysis in 1210 for a new trial.
But you would concede that whether or not the defense counsel exercised due diligence is relevant to the inquiry at the debate?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think, though, in just adding on to that, that perhaps the military judge was thinking that was really superfluous information, that she had established, the record established that fact, and so it became either confusing or cumulative at that point. In the end, this record is sufficiently fleshed out, and certainly, especially based on the Air Force Court's opinion, is adequate in that doing the analysis and petition for new trial. Let me go though to harm here, whether this is determined to be of constitutional magnitude in which the government has to establish harm beyond reasonable doubt, or just prejudice analysis. That this information, whether you take it in regards with a proffer or with all the information established in the affidavit submitted to the Air Force Court, really doesn't change the outcome of the trial or the analysis for the petition for new trial. As contrary to what appellant, I think, suggests in the brief, this is really not the sole witness. This is not the typical scenario you see these impeachment, confrontation clause types of cases. This is really a collateral witness. The main evidence in this case was the UA, which was at over 8,000 nanograms with a cutoff of 500 nanograms of ecstasy. He was involved with other drug users, McKenzie and Welsh, and Dr. Jane testified that there was no problems with the analysis, that everything seemed to go okay with regards to the testing procedure. In that part of the issue of her testimony regarding the him seemingly being nervous was really also just cumulative testimony with Mr. Cousins, who's the DRPM, and Captain Williams, who's the JAG at the testing site. They testified to the same type of nervousness. So in the end, and unlike the cases that appellant cites in this case, is all those involved either the prosecution, affirmatively withholding the information, or that the witness was the only critical witness and involved as a confidential informant or otherwise.
So what information was there about prior drug use in the record in this case?
There's not necessarily any information. I guess the only other piece of information that was different was the Sergeant Langley's testimony about the nine pills that was, I suppose, being offered by the appellant. But again, that piece of information was corroborated by another OSI agent in which she called that same nine. So to suggest that somehow her credibility is significantly impacted by the fact that she did or didn't say anything about incentive pay is really minuscule here. The only piece of information that's not cumulative from other witnesses is information that's corroborated by another investigator. And so the appellant makes much to do really about nothing, because what is it that he was going to do differently here? He suggests he's going to ask about incentive pay. Sergeant Langley, is it true you were offered incentive pay? Yes, but I didn't accept it, and I didn't know I was going to get it till the trials were, at least four of the trials were completed. How is that significant impeachment information, if it is impeachment information at all? So, in the end, the government requests that this court find that the military judge did not err, and that even if she did err, it was harmless, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Just to go back to your last set of statements, are you suggesting that an offer of incentive pay, even if the person says they didn't take it, and which they subsequently received some pay, that is not useful impeachment evidence?
I'm sorry, Ben.
That's not useful impeachment evidence if somebody's offered incentive pay, which they later accept, even if they say that at the time they didn't have an intent to accept it?
I guess we're suggesting that there would be a different outcome, or if you look at the analysis in the petition for new trial situation, that it's not a piece of information that necessitates a new trial.
I think you said if there was error that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Do you think that that's what the standard is in this case?
Well, I guess the government first suggests that this type of information, it's really unclear that we're talking about impeachment. The government argues that what the proffer suggests is it's not impeachment, therefore not of constitutional magnitude, that it's more along the lines of do we establish an element of the due diligence issue.
So the government's position is any impeachment evidence is tested for harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think it rises to I guess the government's argument is that if it's of a issue of confrontation or impeachment, that it would be a constitutional issue. If there are no other questions,
thank you very much. I assume by the amount of time reserved that the defense has rebuttal in this case.
Regarding the proper evidence that I discussed earlier, at the bottom of page 65, the military judge was trying to figure out why Major Martin's testimony would be relevant. The defense counsel stated it's relevant because the information, even if it came out here on the witness stand, is that there was an offer of payment to her, a fact that she did not divulge to anybody. This information she kept to herself. So later on page 67, goes on to indicate that Major Martin's going to be testifying to say that this information could have been received pre-trial, and it should have been received based upon the questions that he asked. The reason the military judge didn't allow this is not because it was a confusing issue. I hope that the military judge alone wouldn't call something confusing and not like to hear it, just considering this court's order, or because of the loathe, as she uses, for calling a defense counsel. It's because she had a myopic view as to what the purpose was for the debate hearing, and she states that on page 68. This fact-finding on this hearing centers largely on the incentive payment that was received after Erwin Key's trial, which was not known at his trial because it hadn't occurred. No, the fact-finding purpose for the debate hearing was whether or not a new trial should be granted. Half of that is whether or not the defense counsel had the opportunity to take a Brewer approach and pursue a line of defense because there's possible incentive to lie. Because the military judge didn't have the right perspective at this trial, everything was considered irrelevant as soon as she found out that the payments were received after Erwin Key's trial. And that's the real problem that we have in this case. Concerning the government's position that it's not cumulative, no, nobody testified that the informant withheld information pre-trial. However, Major Martin would testify that she did. Certainly not cumulative, considering that nobody else at the debate hearing testified to that. As to changing the outcome of the trial, from a military judge airing standpoint, the issue is whether or not relevant testimony was excluded. It was. We consider the exclusion of that evidence to be error because her findings of fact were necessarily altered. But from a broader standpoint, if we do want to talk about whether or not the harm in this case ever occurred, it certainly did. It was a UA case, sure, it was 16 times the level, but we're talking about an innocent ingestion defense that the defense was trying to put on. The girlfriend of the appellant testified that, yes, she gave him two pills that night at the bar. Well, as soon as the defense is able to explore a motivation to lie, all of a sudden, that innocent ingestion defense becomes much more plausible in light of the girlfriend's testimony. Lastly, the Supreme Court case of May versus Illinois must also have some bearing. The Supreme Court held that when the reliability of the witness may well be determinative of guilt or innocence, non-disclosure of evidence affecting credibility falls within the general rule requiring a new trial. So here, there is a reliability of the witness that's called into question. Non-disclosure of evidence is what occurred in this case. There was that issue of offering being received incentive payments that never came out. That Supreme Court case is on point to say that a new hearing, new trial, should be granted. The bottom line is that this court ordered a debate hearing to figure out if there was a new trial. The military judge did not embrace such a court order and instead conducted her own fact-finding on what she believed was going to be an appropriate arena to address. It didn't adequately do it. This court's order was violated from a policy standpoint, in addition to the law that's in place. Court's orders have to be followed. It wasn't in this case, and as a right, and as a fact, as a reality, the appellant did not receive a fair debate hearing, and accordingly, we request that a new hearing be ordered, otherwise, an alternative, a new trial. Thank you.
Assuming that the DeBay hearing should have heard from the trial defense counsel. What specific facts now would you ask this court to rely upon in ordering a new trial? Or are you suggesting that we should simply order a further DeBay hearing at this point to allow that testimony to be presented and evaluated?
Based upon the issue that was granted upon, a form of relief would be a new DeBay hearing in the defense's position. However, it's also within this court's discretion to order a new trial, and that's what the defense also, or the appellant, requests. And the additional facts of the new trial would be that, one, that motivation to lie is ultimately going to be extremely important, a critical piece of information that the defense can use tactically to try to impeach the witnesses at trial. Truly, the only witness that talked about access or opportunity regarding ecstasy. Sure, there was a positive analysis, but the mammogram level is of no significance when you have an innocent ingestion type defense. So as soon as Major Martin can come and testify, or it comes out at trial that not only would this individual not lie at the debate hearing, but if the original trial withheld information, then that certainly could help the defense with exploring and at least exploiting that innocent ingestion defense.
Thank you.
Any questions for me?
Thank you very much. That concludes the argument in this case. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. And the court will recess until 5 minutes before 10 o'clock. Second case this morning is United States against Wilson. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Ryan Swift, and along with Lieutenant Steve Hendricks, I represent the appellant in this matter, Private Alexander Wilson. We're not here today to decide whether Private Wilson would have prevailed in a contested trial under a claim of mistaken fact as to age. We're here to decide whether Private Wilson had a right to be made aware of such an offense and make a decision for himself whether to raise it in a contested trial. This court found recently in the case of Zachary that mistake of fact as to age is in fact a defense with respect to the offense of sodomy with a minor. And reading directly from this court's recent decision in Zachary, the military judge has a duty under Article 45 to explain to the accused the defense the accused raises during a providence inquiry. Further in Zachary, Article 45 requires that in a guilty plea case, inconsistencies in apparent defenses must be resolved by a military judge, and guilty pleas must be rejected. And finally, and most importantly, where an accused is misinformed, as in this case, as to possible defenses, a guilty plea must be set aside.
Okay, counsel. Zachary was an indecent acts case. It was not an Article 125 case.
Right.
Congress, despite repeated invitations, has steadfastly refused to tinker with Article 125. 2 years ago, the Department of Defense sent over a draft bill asking for substantial revisions in the article. Neither House of Congress included it in its mark. Nobody mentioned it on the floor. Article 125 hasn't been amended in years. Are we supposed to simply import this into Article 125 when Congress has explicitly refused to do so?
Well, I think to the extent that this court essentially imported the defense into the indecent acts.
Wasn't there some legislative history on which the court, at least some, in some ways, could rely on in Zachary that is totally not present here?
The congressional history in discussing the amendment back in 1996 with respect to the common knowledge statute, in where contentiously Zachary basically says, and obviously
counsel, just a second. I think that what Judge Stuckey is asking about and what I would like to hear about is not about Zachary. I'd like to hear about what the statute says and what the rule says. So why don't you talk about those two matters?
Again, the statute, the amendment in 1996 specifically addressed only the offense of common knowledge. And speaking to this court, or I should say the congressional intent, which was actually found in one of the conference reports, I believe, talked about the whole purpose of that amendment was to conform military law to the spirit of the Sexual Abuse Act of 1986. And in that act, or in federal law, all of the offenses with a child are grouped together as one. And the mistake of fact offense applies to all of those offenses, to include sodomy specifically.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the case in the code, is it?
No, as it wasn't the case with indecent acts either at that time.
Is there an offense of indecent acts with a child in the code?
Not in the code.
Is there an offense of sodomy with a child in the code?
Oh, yes, there is.
There is?
Oh, I apologize. An offense of sodomy
right.
in the code? Yes, there is.
Sodomy with a child?
Yes, there is.
And what's the difference between that then and the Article 120 offense?
The difference only being the acts, not the people involved or the ages of the people involved, the difference only being the actual physical nature of the sexual involvement.
Right. Where in the code does it say sodomy with a child?
Article 125.
Distinguish between the code and the manual, if you would.
Right.
I think that's what Judge Efron's asking you.
I don't answer that question.
Well, do you have Article 125 in front of you?
I can do it. Yes, Your Honor.
I don't see the offense of sodomy with a child in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Isn't that something that the President has identified in the manual for courts martial as a separate offense for purposes of aggravating the offense of sodomy?
Well, I think, though, that the actual age does, in its essence, become and basically essentially become an element of that offense.
I understand that, but my question goes to the question of what difference does it make whether any legislation was presented or considered by Congress at all in this, because we're not dealing with a statutory offense.
I think, if we're going back to the intent of Congress, I think it's clear that what Congress is trying to do is make the military law as it pertains to sexual offenses of minors to conform to the spirit of civilian law.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, and let's talk about what the Model Penal Code and how it treats mistake of fact with respect to the aggravating factor of the person involved in sodomy being between the ages of 12 and 16 years old. Are you familiar with the Model Penal Code? I'm sorry? Okay, I would just for purposes of after argument, I would suggest that you look at section 2.04 and 213.3, because my understanding of the way that it is treated under the Model Penal Code, understanding that it's the Model Penal Code and not itself a statute that has been accepted by any legislative body, but there is no mistake of fact, reasonable or otherwise, available for the offense of sodomy.
It's really getting back to what is again, the intent of Congress and you know, as a policy matter, that why should military soldiers be, or service members be treated any differently if that defense is not available to them that would otherwise they would have in the civilian world?
Okay, well, where in the civilian world is the defense of mistake of fact available with respect to the age element as an aggravating factor of the offense of sodomy?
And again, I think the argument is that it's really not an aggravating factor. It is essentially what I'm asking.
It is treated, whether you call it an aggravating factor or whether you call it an element, the effect is the same, that that enhanced punishment is available, right?
Enhanced punishment, among other things, the conviction that in and of itself, you know, is above and beyond. I mean,
so answer my question, where in the civilian world is that fact where in the civilian world is the fact of the age of the child, a reasonable mistake of fact with respect to the age, a defense? Because you keep on telling us that military members should have the same defenses available to them as are available in the civilian world. So where in the civilian world is that is that defense available?
I believe it's available in the Sexual Abuse Act Convention 6. I believe that act talks about carnal law, it talks about sodomy with a minor, it talks about other types of things, and the defense in that realm is available under that context.
And would you agree with me that this sort of offense is ordinarily going to be one that is chargeable under state rather than federal law?
In most cases, probably, yes.
Okay. In what state law is there a reasonable mistake of fact defense available for this type of offense?
I'm not able to quote anything right now.
He was actually charged under Article 125 based on the elements promulgated by the President in the manual, was he not?
That's correct.
And not under the Model Penal Code or Vermont statute or whatever?
No, yeah.
Okay. Unless I'm reading the wrong manual, under paragraph B, the elements are given in addition to the statutory elements, the additional element that the act was done with a child who had attained the age of 12 but was under the age of 16. Now that comes under the subheading B, elements. Is that or is not that an element to start with?
I would argue that is an element of the offense, and that's something that, in the context especially of a guilty plea, that the military judge is going to have to go over with the soldier, and in the context of a...
Okay, if we accept for the purposes of argument that that's an element, how do we know whether that's an element that the President intended to have general intent mens rea, strict liability mens rea, or specific intent mens rea?
Just based on the language alone.
Or do you agree that it needs to have one of those?
I would agree.
Let me first do the leading part of the question, and then now let me ask you, which does that element have and how do we know?
I think based on its face, it would seem that general intent would probably be the... I don't think it's meant to be a strict liability offense. That would sort of wouldn't stand a reason as to when somebody has a reasonable and honest mistake, as in this case.
Well, let's go back. Is this a common law offense or a... whatever the opposite is. A non-common law offense. A statutory offense or a public welfare offense?
I believe in this context it would probably be a statutory offense, browsing out of common.
I'm not asking you to guess. I'm asking you what your position is.
The position
is sodomy understood generally to be a common law offense or a statutory offense?
I think as a common law offense.
Is that your position, or is that what you're guessing? My answer should be, I don't have an answer.
That's
I'm trying to.
Right now, no.
Okay. What is the general rule with respect to common law offenses? Looking at Staples.
I'm not familiar with that.
Well, let me try it this way. What in the manual would give us an indication as to whether this should be applied as a general intent or a strict liability element?
I think, again, this just looking at the other offenses, looking at, number one, the carnal knowledge statute, and also how now the defense applies to carnal knowledge, I think it's clear that, you know, it should be taken as a general intent, not... not one whereby just by virtue of an age of a person, that's it and that's all, and game over.
But clearly the president could be more specific one way or the other, right?
He could, and I'm not so sure but that doesn't, that probably isn't dispositive as to what.
Which way does that cut?
I'm sorry, sir.
Which way does that cut? How do you deal with that?
If you cut against him, that, well, if the president wanted to say that, well, he could say that. But I think to some extent we're here to sort of interpret as to what would be the intent in this case. And there's nothing to indicate that this is intended to be a strict liability offense, and I don't believe there's anything other to suggest that that's the right one that occurs.
Counsel, my understanding of the briefs in this case is that this particular issue, although the parties' positions are not binding on the court, is not a matter of dispute between the parties. That is, as I read the government's brief, it says mistake of fact regarding age can be a defense to sodomy with a minor.
That's correct.
And that reflects language in Zachary. Zachary interpreted a statute. And the question then is whether the same logic would apply to non-statutory offenses. That is, if mistake of fact is a defense to the crime of rape or carnal knowledge, then it would also be a defense as to similar sexual activity. So that's why we have in Zachary that language. Is that your understanding of it?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And essentially, and again, and to point out, obviously, that the government doesn't contest that issue as we raised in our brief either. But to the extent that the defense is applicable under Zachary or otherwise, the defense certainly was raised during the problems inquiry. First and foremost, out of the judge's mouth, out of the accused's mouth, Private Wilson says, she told me she was 18 years old, which is followed quickly by, did she look 18 to you? At which point, Private Wilson said, she did, yes. At this point, the defense has been raised. And based on Zachary and other cases of the type dealing with defenses raised at a guilty plea, the judge at this point was under a duty to instruct and advise Private Wilson with respect to that defense. However, the military judge actually misinforms and tells him that it completely is not a defense. That's a great indicator as to whether it was actually raised at the trial level, in that the military judge is even acknowledging, hey, there's an issue here. This person is saying that he thought she was of legal age, which she brought then upon herself to say, no, that's actually not the case. It doesn't matter. Essentially, in saying that it's a strict liability offense at that point. It doesn't matter what she thought her age was. It only matters actually what her age was. Other indicators throughout this trial that the issue had been raised was the simple fact that everybody in the courtroom sort of dealing off the same premise during this court-martial. If you look at the way that it was handled, they're going off the premise that on October 13th of 2003, that's the actual date by which Private Wilson became, or had actual knowledge, so to speak, age. There was a circumstance whereby they were actually arrested at the Queen Mom in Fort Texas, and a jailer actually told him at that point that he says that he believed she was 15 years old. And you'll notice also that the charge sheet is actually amended to reflect that issue. He's charged also with carnal knowledge in this case, although obviously there's no issue as to whether he was or the judge failed to instruct or misinformed with defense with respect to carnal knowledge, because he admits after the 13th I continued to have sex with her, but before the 13th that's when the sodomy offenses occurred, and I didn't know she was 15 at that time.
Counsel, carnal knowledge basically criminal makes age dispositive with regard to an act, consensual intercourse, that's otherwise legal.
Right.
Article 125 prohibits sodomy without regard as to age or any other. It simply prohibits it, correct?
Correct, with the catch that we're talking about, obviously, with respect to the elements that are laid out by the president.
Well, leaving aside the elements that are laid out by the president, the statute. The statute doesn't purport to criminalize an otherwise legitimate act under some circumstances. It simply criminalizes it, does it not?
Yes.
So, could Congress not have made a reasoned distinction between sodomy, the separate sodomy statute, and carnal knowledge, which turns on age?
I suppose they could have, Your Honor, but I think if you look at the Decisions Act and what it's citing and what the actual congressional...
Well, I'm not asking what Zachary said. I'm asking whether Congress could have made a rational legislative distinction.
They could have, but I don't think that's what is supported by when the amendment actually occurred with respect to carnal knowledge and the mistake of fact defense. I think that it's clear that what Congress was trying to do was to conform those offenses, or make available all the defenses available for all of the sexual intercourse or sexual involvement, I should say.
Well, then it brings me back to my original question, which is why Congress, despite repeated invitations to do so from, among other people, the administration, has explicitly refused to touch 125.
I can't answer that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Say, and similarly, though, I would go on to say, you know, with respect to the indecent acts that were found in Zachary, and the Congress had the ability to do that as well, and they failed to do so back in 1996.
What was the appellant actually charged with? What did the specification say?
That he was charged with in that trial, as an adolescent, did it at Mid-Fernier, Texas, on University of Fraser, found about 13 2003, and 2003 commits sodomy with T.J. Smith, a child under the age of 16 years.
What relevance, if any, does the fact that the specification which the government drafted includes the child's age?
It makes it not just an aggravating factor, but essentially a central element that the military judge needs to instruct the civil law on. Also, if this were a contested case, it would be an additional element that would have to be proved up in front of the jury.
Does the fact that the government has to prove that the child, in fact, was under 16, is that the same thing as that they have to prove that the individual knew that the child was under 16? Those aren't necessarily the same thing, are they?
We don't need to prove, you know, unless there's contrary.
To be clear, my question was a flat question that had no spin to it. I want you to tell me what relevance, if any, that has.
And the relevance being that it's something that needs to be proved up, just like every other element of offense. I don't think the government's in a position to disprove that there was or prove out that there was actual specific intent or there wasn't a mistake in belief in fact. But to the extent that that's raised, well, then it puts it in the realm of that's an issue that needs to be resolved. Or it's certainly something that would be available to him in a contested court.
Well, if the government had proved an act of sodomy occurred, but had not proved age, would there be an offense under 125?
There would be an offense, although that's open to argument as well, and that was one of the second issues that was briefed to this court with respect to how that offense how that offense relates to the court's Supreme Court decision in Lawrence and also this court's decision.
Well, leaving that aside for the moment.
But yes, it does.
Going back to Judge Stuckey's question before, what are we to make of you're arguing that the Congress had intended to amend all these sex type of offenses back at the same time. What are we to make of the fact that the Congress specifically amended Article 125 and that the President specifically amended RCM 916L with respect to one offense, but not with respect to sodomy.
With respect to which offense, ma'am?
Carnal knowledge.
Carnal knowledge, okay. I think it just goes back to, I mean, you could argue almost as, it may be as simple as someone dropping the ball, the way the statute was drafted. I mean, clearly they talk about carnal knowledge, but the intent is clear from the conference report, I believe, that talks about what they were actually trying to do with the statute. So the extent that the president, amends the RCN to reflect what the statute says. There's a similar mistake that almost or missing of the issue there on the part of the president as well.
Okay, but when you look at J1, I mean, it talks at the bottom of J1. However, if the accused knowledge or intent is immaterial as to an element, then ignorance or mistake is not a defense. Isn't that exactly the situation that we have here with respect to age and adultery? That the accused doesn't have to know or intend that the object of the adultery, that the object of the sodomy is under the age of 16, even though the government has to prove that she's under 16.
Right. But I think really what we're talking about here is, you know, what should be available to a soldier during in a court-martial, and, you know, what's the difference between, you know, with respect to a crime knowledge offense, why should it be any different with indecent
acts? But isn't that a policy argument that ought to be directed toward Congress?
And again, I think that Congress's is intent was somewhat clear, and it was made clear in Zachary that, you know, the defense of mistake of fact as to age is something that should be available to the entire realm of offenses that deal with child sex or child sexual interaction.
But do you understand how it's a little bit hard to accept the proposition that it's clear that Congress intended something that doesn't, that because it isn't in the statute, and that it's clear that the president intended as a policy matter something that isn't in the RCM? I mean, that's a little bit of a difficult argument to accept.
I understand your position on it, but I think it really just goes back to what is really intended when Carl Mollis is even given the ability to have a defense of mistake of fact. What it's really about is, you know, making available to the soldier what he would otherwise be available to have had he been charged under the federal law. And in this case, that's exactly the situation that has arisen. I see that my time is over, so that I'll briefly conclude. It's our position, and this was not disputed in the government's brief, that there is an available defense of mistake of fact as to age with respect to sodomy. And that's based on not only Zachary, but also the 1996 language with regard to the congressional intent and the conference report. And secondarily, that it was reasonably raised throughout the trial, not only in the beginning, but continuing throughout. And that as such, the military judge had a duty to appraise him, apprise him of this defense, not to misinform him after its applicability. And as such, this court should set aside the sodomy offense and return the case to the Army Court for a sentence reception.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
And I, along with Colonel John Lloyd II, represent the government in this case. Much like an ostrich, appellant chose to stick his head in the sand to ignore the warnings from his victim's grandmother, mother, and former boyfriend that his victim was only 15 years old. Appellant asked this court to condone his deliberate ignorance of his victim's true age by setting aside his guilty plea as improvident. Appellant does not deserve such a windfall. As this court did in United States v. Garcia, and recently in United States v. Shaw, this court should uphold appellant's guilty plea as provident. In United States v. Garcia, this court held that because mistake of fact, that affirmative defense was never raised, it was not necessary for appellant Garcia to expressly disavow the defense to maintain his guilty plea. Garcia never raised the complete defense because under the facts that he gave the military judge, any mistaken belief that he had that his victims consented to his touching was not objectively reasonable. We have the same situation in this case. The facts that appellant Wilson gave to the military judge demonstrated that his mistaken belief is just simply not objectively reasonable.
Counsel, I have a question. Given that Zachary is not itself an Article 125 case, why is the government conceding that Zachary controls the outcome of this case? Why is that your argument?
Well, because we saw in the United States v. Zachary language that suggested that this court was going to apply mistake of fact to the offense of sodomy.
Do you think that that's what the statute or the RCM suggests is a correct answer with respect to sodomy? Or are you prepared to discuss that?
Well, I will state that we did take a look at the sodomy offense under Article 125, and given that under the elements section, that it does state as an element a child under the age of 16.
Does it say that they have to know that they're under the age of 16?
Well, combine that with the mistake of fact defense laid out in the RCM, which says that if a person has a mistaken belief that for a general intent crime, it must be both honest and reasonable.
And what about the last line under J1, where it talks about whether a mistake of fact defense is available when the intent or knowledge with respect to the element doesn't matter? I mean, if you're not prepared to discuss this, then just tell me so.
As far as whether this is a strict liability offense or a general intent crime, for mistake of fact, it is a strict liability offense if the child is under 12. But looking at the mistake of fact rather than current knowledge, if the child is between 12 and 16, as the defense had pointed out, mistake of fact defense could apply.
Wasn't the statement as to sodomy and Zachary dictum?
Yes, ma'am. If this court did decide that mistake of fact regarding a child's age is not a defense, then that ends the inquiry, and appellant's plea is provident, and military judge did not err. But again, we wanted to consider the possibility that this court wanted to extend Zachary and hold that mistake of fact could be a defense regarding sodomy with a minor.
It's just to be clear, when you just spoke, were you providing the government's position or the government's position, or the government's characterization of Zachary? What is the government's position?
The government's characterization of Zachary.
So the government has no position on how Article 125, as applied to the President's elements, should be interpreted and applied?
No.
The government comes before this court today, so if a prosecutor called you and they said, how should we charge this, you'd say we have no position?
No, we would advise the government to charge sodomy with a child under 16.
Okay, and what would you advise, what would the government's position be as to whether the President intended that to be a strict liability element or a general intent element?
At this point, we have to consider this court's decision in Zachary and account for the possibility that mistake of fact could be a defense.
I understand your position. Thank you.
And the President, is there any activity to amend the manual for courts martial to remove that as a defense with respect to sodomy?
I don't recall. However, with respect to sexual offenses, the government would note that Article 120 is being changed to include all offenses except for sodomy. It is being maintained as a separate Article 125 offense.
Doesn't that tell us something about the question as to the issue of why 125 hasn't been changed? That is, has there been a conscious decision on the part of Congress to not change Article 125 because Congress is fixated on this question of the age of people who commit Article 125 offenses? Or could it possibly be that other aspects of Article 125 regarding conduct, either between consenting adults or among persons of the same gender, might be a reason why Congress has had a little bit of reluctance to address Article 125?
No, I don't know the answer to that question. Again, getting back to the guilty plea in this particular case, if this court were to decide that mistake of fact regarding age is a defense to sodomy, it's our position that appellant, it was impossible for appellant to raise that defense during his providence inquiry and also in his unsworn statement.
I mean, in this case, assuming that it was a defense, it wasn't a question of him raising it, it was a question of the military judge telling him it wasn't available, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so then what's the standard after that?
Then this court would test for whether it was harmless, harmless error. And under the circumstances of this case, that error was harmless because even though appellant repeatedly said, I thought she was 18, that belief was not honest given that three different people warned him that she was 15 years old. And also, it was not reasonable.
Does it matter in this case that even if there was such a defense available, and even if he did believe it, that his conduct would nonetheless have been an offense under Article 125, which I think goes back to what Judge Stuckey raised earlier?
If he had committed sodomy with a person who was an adult, that may not be a crime.
Well, here's a question. Just thinking of this is, what if he had a reasonable mistake of fact as to her age? Does that have any impact on the constitutional analysis when, in fact, she was not 16?
If this court decided that mistake of fact was a defense, and further, if his mistake was both honest and reasonable, then, yes, there would be a constitutional issue under Lawrence and Marco.
Even though she's not 16, in fact?
Correct, Your Honor. Because when the state of fact defense states that if you have an honest and reasonable belief of facts that would make you not guilty of a crime, then you are not guilty. But again, the facts that appellant gave the military judge in this case demonstrated at the very least that his mistake of fact regarding Ms. Smith's age was not reasonable.
Isn't sodomy under 125, leaving Lawrence and its progeny aside, isn't sodomy a strict liability offense? You commit sodomy, you're guilty of sodomy. Now, you've got sentence enhancers like doing with a child. But isn't sodomy basically a strict liability offense, leaving aside Lawrence and his progeny? You commit sodomy with another.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, let's see if I understand the implications of that, your argument here. Putting aside Lawrence, etc., if we were to determine that the plea inquiry was deficient, I'm not asking you to concede that now, but if we were to determine that, could we affirm the offense of sodomy and affirm the sentence based upon what's here, putting aside the issue of Lawrence?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is the government's position with respect to that? That is, putting aside the issue of Lawrence, would you prefer, if we were to find that the plea was not provident, for us to affirm the offense of sodomy and affirm the sentence, or would you prefer to have the opportunity to go back to trial at the special court-martial and prove the offense of sodomy with a child?
Between the two alternatives, we would prefer that this court affirm sodomy and then affirm the sentence, Your Honor.
Okay. Then to go to the larger question, which was raised by the previous dialogue, is it not possible for us to do that in that case in light of Lawrence and Markham, in the sense that that would then deprive the defense of the opportunity to raise the constitutional issue? Or are there facts in this case under Markham which would permit us to affirm the sentence and the findings for a simple sodomy without the necessity of reaching the constitutional issue?
This court could affirm sodomy applying the Markham test. as appellants admitted that at least one time he committed the offense in his barracks room. There is a military nexus. We also have that appellant, and she purported to be pregnant as a result of appellant's sexual intercourse with her.
How do those create Markham elements? I mean, how does that take this out of Markham and out of Lawrence? Those facts that you just mentioned, that it happened in the barracks room, that she was a military dependent, that she got pregnant as a result of sodomy, I guess you're... I mean, I'm not sure of that.
She got pregnant as a result of the carnal knowledge.
Okay. So, again, how do those three specific facts that you just listed make this a constitutional... make us able to avoid the constitutional issue in light of Markham and Lawrence? If, as you say... if she's over 16 for purposes of mistake of fact, then she's over 16 for purposes of Markham and Lawrence, which I think is what you said.
Actually, if we could provide supplemental.
Is the constitutional issue before this court at this time?
No, it was not. Defense had
Can you return to, you said that the defense of mistake of fact was not reasonably raised?
Correct.
Assuming there is a such a defense. Can you give your checklist of items that indicates that in the record, in the page reference and all that hula?
That is mistake of not reasonable?
Correct.
Well, if you look at, first of all, the statement to CID, and you look at the stipulation of fact that his statement was attached to, in the stipulation of fact, paragraph 4 for Charlie, the accused admits that on or about 28 September 2003, the accused located in Plano, Texas. At that time, the parent's mother would and she was only 15 years old and in the ninth grade.
Hang on. How do you deal with the fact that this stipulation says that she states that she advised him? Isn't this the old, I admit that this is what you'll say versus I admit that what you say is true?
Well, we look at him saying the mother did state this, I admit, the mother stated this to me. But then take a look at his statement to CID, where he says, I became suspicious of Miss Age when I ran into an ex-boyfriend at Walmart, and he told me that she was only 15 years old.
So you have the CID statement.
Journal.
One. Two, you have whatever one can infer from paragraph 4C.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you agree that there's it may be a difference that doesn't change things, but that there is a difference between admitting that someone will state something and admitting that what they state is true.
Yes, Your Honor. When a parent states, well, I didn't know until the police officer told me on October 13th, that demonstrates that she heard the warnings from the grandmother, the mother, and the former boyfriend, but he chose to ignore them. And under those circumstances, that would constitute conscious avoidance. Essentially, what he's doing is putting his hands over his ears and telling people, I can't hear anyone tell me that she's 15 years old.
So is it your position that after 13 October, it doesn't matter?
Correct, Your Honor.
And what does the record reflect, the plea record reflect, occurred after 13 October that would make the plea provident?
Well, down at the lower court, they put the end date of this offense as October 13th. So that is what we are bound by.
So the government, he's not, in the government's view, he's not convicted of something that occurred on October 14th or after? Okay.
Correct, Your Honor. It's only from September 13th to October 13th. But again, looking at what he told the military judge in conjunction with the stipulation of facts, and his statement that was attached to it, he acknowledged to performing oral sex on Ms. Smith at least three times, during the same time that he was being warned by people who had known her all her life, that she was only 15 years old. And he also acknowledged to the military judge on page 31, that he remembered the last time that he performed oral sodomy on Ms. Smith was about 2 weeks before he talked to CID. And giving him the full benefit of that 2 weeks, he acknowledged that he committed sodomy on Ms. Smith on October 7th. So he committed it at least one time after he'd been warned by three different people over the course of 4 days that Ms. Smith was only 15 years old and in the ninth grade. Under those circumstances, appellant consciously avoided the warnings that he was given. He also failed to conduct a reasonable investigation. And under United States v. True and United States v. Spann, that negligence on his part makes his mistake unreasonable. Has not said what he would have, has not demonstrated to this court that he would have told the military judge anything differently had the military judge advised him that mistake of fact was a defense. From the United States v. Lockwood and United States v. Thompson, that failure is in favor of the government and against appellant. Is there any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May I briefly conclude here? Applying the law to the facts of this case, this court should find as a matter of law that it is impossible for the court to raise the complete defense of mistake of fact. Appellant's facts demonstrated that his belief is reasonable. Therefore, this court should hold that the military judge did not abuse her discretion in not conducting further inquiry. As this court did in Garcia and Shaw, this court should affirm the military judge's decision to accept appellant's guilty plea and affirm the Army Court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Does the defense have a rebuttal, please?
Briefly, to touch upon the issue as to whether what import, if any, Zachary has in this case with respect to sodomy. And first and foremost, I think it's our position is that the statement by this court with respect to sodomy in the Zachary case was meant as sort of a useful practical tool for practitioners to say, hey, this is this based on what the intent of the Congress back in 1996 is sufficient and can be used.
Is that some new category between holding and dicta?
No,
the practical guide.
It brings it closer to being part of the holding. But what I would say is that the sodomy, the dicta statement or the statement regarding sodomy exactly should be imported into this case. And
so you're not contesting that it's dicta?
Not conceded.
You were taking a multiple choice test and you have dicta or holding. Which would you check?
It just seems like a fairly important statement to make in dicta. And it would seem, though, that this court should import that into this case. And the similarities being between, and this is something that you were going at me with before, the similarities between sodomy offenses and calling law, or I should say sodomy and indecent acts, with respect to the age, is that the age element is just that. It's an element in both of those offenses, and it's something that was not contained in the statute for indecent acts, and it's not contained in the statute for sodomy with a minor. So in essence, the president, chose to act with respect to what Congress did in the RCM with respect to common knowledge, but But to my knowledge, there's nothing that's happened since Zachary with respect to this indecent acts.
Counsel, with respect to Lockwood and Thompson, could you address the government's argument that in the absence of any statement by your client as to what he would have said, why should we presume that he did have a defense of honest and reasonable mistake?
Well, it's not really talking about what he would have said. We're talking about what he did in fact say during numerous points throughout this court martial.
Right.
If you want to take it on a very quick note, once he says, hey, she told me she was 18 and she looked 18, well, our position is that's enough. But that's not the only point throughout
this case. But the government's raised these two cases, Lockwood and Thompson, for the proposition. You may not agree with it, or you may not agree with these cases stand for the proposition that it's not enough for the defense in attacking a providency inquiry to show that the judge should have asked more, that the defense has to be able to show that there was, in fact, a defense available.
Well, I don't necessarily agree to what those cases stand for, but as applied to this case, clearly it almost seems to be putting a burden on a soldier during the providence inquiry to have to admit to facts that they establish a complete defense. And I think this court, in several cases, has said that a soldier need not do that, specifically in Philippi, which I believe is quoted by the government. And also, I realize in the Shaw case, in a sense, mentioned that a soldier need not raise a complete defense, only that he raised the possibility that defense exists.
And you're quoting the dissent?
Well, no,
how about trying the majority opinion, since that's a fairly recent opinion? How would you distinguish Shaw if you're going to distinguish it?
Well, in Shaw, the holding is saying that in the case of a bipolar disorder, where a soldier, which happens many times in the province inquiry, spouts off and says that I'm bipolar, or that I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. What Shaw is saying is that in and of itself isn't enough to raise the defense of lack of mental responsibility. And that based on the fact that sometimes bipolar disorder can be so severe as to raise perhaps that element that there's a severe mental disease or defect. But that's wholly different and separate from the situation where someone says, I'm bipolar and that's it, and there's nothing else on the record to indicate that. Whereas you have a record that's strewn with evidence suggests that this soldier had a reasonable and honest mistake of fact, as in this case. And to the extent that there's factors in the stipulation of fact that perhaps might go to an argument that perhaps this mistake of fact wasn't reasonable or honest, well, at that point, we're getting into a situation where we've got good facts on one side and we've got bad facts on the other side. The government relies heavily on the fact that they say that the parent, the mother and grandmother say that they told him this. Well, I think what was being discussed before is that's not actually what was stipulated to. What was stipulated to is that if this person were called to testify, well, that's what they'd say. You've got, a good argument on both sides, but that's not what a providence inquiry is all about. A providence inquiry is to make sure this soldier isn't pleading guilty, not knowing, what's going on. He must believe that he's guilty. He must know why he was pleading guilty and what's available to him. That was his decision once this defense was raised to be made aware of it, not misinformed as to it.
Counsel, two things. First, just to be clear, I'm not faulting you for relying on Zachary. I may disagree with your analysis of the manual provisions, but I don't fault you for relying on that case. I just wanted to be clear about that. Secondly, what is your response to the question that I asked the government about whether, if we agreed with you that there was a mistake of fact defense available, and if we agreed with you that his mistake in this case was an honest and reasonable one, what is your view as to what effect that has on whether he can be guilty of any offense under sodomy at all?
Well, and I think that's going to obviously Williams and Malcolm. I think there's two answers. I think there's no facts to, if you take the age out of it, there's nothing to indicate that there's anything but a private, consensual interlude, if you will.
So you agree with the government that if she's over 16 for purposes of being guilty of the offense, that she's over 16 for purposes of warrants and...
That's exactly what I'm saying. And there's no evidence to suggest that this was done anywhere but in a closed barracks room. And that again goes to, this court, again, talking about what it if it was charged with that, the province inquiry probably would have been done a little bit differently. Certainly you could have raised the issue at the time, but secondarily, the judge would have asked the questions to ensure that this surgery was in fact proper to the consensual settlement offense, and that just isn't available here.
You said the record was strewn,
yes, sir,
with indications that he thought she was over 16. Can you just recite the strunation, please?
Apparently, I'm not going to look that word up. Well, first and foremost, his statements to the judge initially, she said she was 18, she looked 18. Secondarily, he talks about the fact that he didn't learn she was 18 until after, or didn't learn she was 15 until after the sodomy offenses had occurred. Thirdly, there was a witness who was actually a government witness, who was adapted by the defense, who was a soldier supervisor, who said this female had called up, had volunteered that she was 18, that he had seen her, that he never questioned. In fact, the trial counsel in the case actually cross-examined the witness and said, so nothing triggered in your mind when you saw her, you know, that she wasn't 18? He said, no, sir, nothing. There was even evidence to suggest that the father had gone to the barracks prior to October 13th and never raised any issue as to with respect to this girl's age. And then, you know, there are issues in the statement of fact where he repeats, I didn't know how old she was. I had dinner with the family. They never said anything to me. So there were certainly sufficient factors to say that it was raised. Now, there certainly aren't to be made to say that perhaps it wasn't honest or perhaps it wasn't reasonable. But that's not the job of a military judge in an Article 35 standpoint. That's an issue for a trial of fact. In this case, Robert Wilson was robbed of that ability to put it to a trial of fact. As a defense counsel, this would have been maybe a very interesting case that we never know. So subject to any further questions, may I briefly conclude? Because it's our position that the mistake of fact offense as to age is applicable, and basing that on partly on Zachary, that it was reasonably raised, and the military judge misinformed Private Wilson with respect to that offense, this court must set aside the finding. We ask that you send it back to ACCA for a sentence review, and also that the factors discussed in Markham are not present. And that the lesser included should not be affirmed either. Thank you.
Wait. Send it back for a sentence rehearing, you just said? How do you send it back?
For assessment, I apologize.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. That concludes the argument, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
The court stands.